famously pointed out that quantum mechanics seems like a very rigid theory, in contrast to many other physical theories, like, say, general relativity, where most of the natural ways you can think about to modify quantum mechanics seem to make it nonsense. Okay, they allow superluminal signal communication, all sorts of things. Okay, so there have been lots of different approaches to trying to construct foils. PR boxes are one very prominent example. In this talk, I'm going to talk about something different, which is using computational complexity to look for foils for quantum mechanics. Okay, so the starting point for this talk is going to be BQP. I was told to write big. Can you all see that? Okay, so this is bounded error quantum polynomial time. This is the class, basically the class of all the computational problems, decision problems, in particular, that are feasibly solvable by a quantum computer. Okay, if you like, this is sort of the central object of study in the theory of quantum computing. How large is this class? What problems does it contain? This class is a well-defined mathematical object that I think encodes a great deal of information about quantum mechanics. Okay, and we know specific things about it. For example, because of Shor's algorithm, we know that it contains the factoring problem. We don't know if it contains the NP-complete problems, but we have some indications that probably it doesn't. We really don't know whether it contains the graph isomorphism problem. Okay, and that's a big subject of active research. Okay, but success of some quantum algorithms, the failure of others, can all sort of be traced back to specific properties of quantum mechanics. Like, for example, its linearity, or the fact that you can do Fourier transforms. Okay, and so on. So, computational complexity theory, I mean, as some of you probably know, we have an immense zoo of complexity classes, right? And so you can often tweak a complexity class to make it slightly more or less powerful. Okay, so what this talk will really be about is what happens when we try to do that to BQP. Okay, and can we get sort of other classes that are somehow close to it? And if so, the question will then arise, can you work backwards from those classes to find sort of alternative physical theories that would give rise to those classes? Okay, it's sort of a strategy for foil finding, if you like. Okay, so why might we want to do this? Well, we're all foil lovers. I shouldn't have to justify it, right? But a few reasons. One is we'd like to have some scientific way to deal with skepticism of quantum computing. So people who say that quantum computing will never work for some fundamental reason, and then for me the question is always sort of how could you change quantum mechanics in such a way that it wouldn't work. Right, and something that my work has been has dealt with for the last couple of years, and something that's really exciting to me right now is limited forms of quantum computation. Okay, so Dan already touched on this in his talk, but we can ask if universal quantum computing is just too hard for current technology, then can we identify interesting subclasses of BQP that may be easier to implement? Okay, and there's a really great dialogue. Most of the time when we're doing a quantum complexity theory, we have sort of almost zero contact with the experimentalists, right? Maybe we have beers with them at conferences or something. Okay, but here's a place where we can actually have a dialogue with them, say, look, if you can't implement all of BQP, can you implement this restricted subclass that requires fewer physical resources, but that still lets you solve some we think classically hard problem? Okay, so I'll tell you more about that. Okay, another reason is we'd like to know what is beyond quantum computing. Okay, so some people have speculated about quantum gravity computers, string computers, whatever, you know, and the problem is that these theories are not sort of mathematically well-defined enough for us to even be able to say, you know, what models of computation do they give rise to, right? If we, you know, the way I often put it is, if we don't even understand what time is in quantum gravity, how are we going to understand what polynomial time is, okay? So, but you know, but one thing that we can try to ask, you know, for the time being, is at least, you know, if there are some more powerful models of computation out there, what are the possible complexity classes floating around that they could possibly correspond to? Okay, so we can sort of work in the other direction. Okay, and then a fourth, you know, reason to be interested in this is just to get, you know, the hope that studying foils will give us deeper insight into standard quantum computation. Okay, and I think that that's actually happened in several cases. Okay, so the first thing that, so this talk is really just going to be a smorgasbord of different foils, and I'm not going to philosophize about them too much, but I hope that you know, people here who are far more qualified than I am can sort of, you know, discover the foundational implications. You know, I'm just going to give you the examples, okay? Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk about is how can you tweak quantum computation to make it weaker, okay, but still not, you know, all the way down to classical computation. Okay, and by now we actually know a lot of ways to, a lot of plausible ways to do this. Okay, so one way to do it is to restrict the depth of quantum circuits. Okay, you can suppose that you're doing a quantum computation, but you can't really maintain coherence for very long. Okay, the whole thing is going to fall apart after, let's say, a logarithmic number of operations. Okay, so you can sort of do as much as you can in parallel, you know, before that happens. This gives you a model that we don't know to be equivalent to full quantum computation. On the other hand, there's a great result of Cleave and Watrous from 2000 that says that this limited model already contains factoring. Okay, so you can already implement Shor's algorithm with using log-depth quantum circuits. Okay, now there's a beautiful open problem due to Richard Joza, which... you know, there's still been, you know, after years, I think almost a decade, there's been very little progress on, which is, so BQNC is this log depth quantum class. I'm going to write a lot of capital letters, okay? I'll try to explain what they mean. But, so this is the question of sort of, can you do anything with full quantum computation, in other words, with BQP, that you cannot do using log-depth quantum computation combined with arbitrary classical computation? Okay? And I think to date, we still do not have any good example of such a problem. You know, I mean, factoring is not an example, as I just discussed. You know, you can take... problems that are complete for quantum computation, but okay, then you're just sort of restating the question, right? So, you know, I believe I can give an oracle separation between these two models, but, you know, find a real problem that really requires the full power of polynomial depth quantum circuits. I think it's a great problem. Okay. Okay, so there's a very old idea for how you could restrict the power of quantum computation. It goes back to the days when people were thinking about what is the power of liquid state NMR, quantum computing, and can it scale? Okay, and so this is a model where you assume that at every time step, so in other words, between every two gate operations, your quantum computer is in a separable mixed state. Okay, so you can have a mixed initial state, and now you can do operations, you can do arbitrary unitary operations, okay, but, or let's say 2-qubit unitary operations, okay, but they have to have the property that they always leave your quantum computer in a separable state of the n qubits, okay? If you ever create entanglement, then your quantum computer explodes, okay? Killing everyone. Okay, so you can apply unitaries that are capable of generating entanglement, but they have to just not generate entanglement for the particular state that you're applying them to. Okay, so this is this is almost like the definition of a contrived model. Okay, but it's still it's been kind of a thorn in people's sides, annoying us because we'd like to say that entanglement is an essential resource for quantum computation. Okay, and this is a model where there's never any entanglement. Right, your state is always a separable mixed state, but no one knows how to simulate it efficiently with a classical computer. Okay, because after all, a separable mixed state could still require exponentially many bits to describe, and it's possible that your state is a separable mixed state at time t, and is also a separable mixed state at time t plus 1, but because of completely different decompositions in the two cases. Okay, so either give a classical simulation or find an example of a problem that you can actually do in this model, which is hard classically. I should mention, an even more annoying thing about this model, which is sort of taunting us even further, is that we like to assume in quantum computing that some of the most basic things that we teach in sort of an intro to a quantum computing class is that it doesn't matter, for example, if you defined your model using qubits or qutrits. Okay, it also doesn't matter if your amplitudes are complex numbers or if they're real numbers or even if they're quaternions. Okay, because all of these are sort of more or less trivial changes to the model, and that you can simulate qubits using qutrits or complex amplitudes using real amplitudes and so forth. Okay, with the separable mixed state model, we don't know any of that. Okay, it's possible that reals versus complex numbers could be completely different. Okay. Okay, so another somewhat related restricted type of quantum computing is what's called the OCQ, the one clean qubit model. Okay, so this is a model where you get one qubit, which is in a pure state, the zero state, and all of your remaining qubits are in the maximally mixed state. Okay, and that sounds really weak, but for this model, we actually do know of problems that are solvable in this model that we don't know how to solve classically. Okay, one is estimating the trace of a unitary matrix, an exponentially large one. Another example, which was shown by Peter Shor and Steve Jordan, is estimating the Jones polynomial for certain special knots, certain special braids. Okay, and they actually showed that that's a complete problem for this one clean qubit model. So as weird as it looks, it actually has a very natural interpretation in topological quantum computing. Okay, so it seems clear that there's something more to be understood about this model. Somehow it's more natural than it has any right to be. Okay, and we know that there's a great result due to Ambianis, Shulman, and Vazirani, which shows that this model cannot simulate a universal quantum computation by any sort of direct gate by gate mapping. Okay, but there still could be some more indirect reason why this model could be universal for quantum computation. We don't know. Yes. Oh, I think the DQC1 is actually a different name for OCQ. Yeah. I might be mistaken. There might be another class, but okay. So another example is the. Dan mentioned the commuting Hamiltonians model due to Bremner, Joza, and Shepard. Okay, this is a model where you know, you can apply a bunch of Hamiltonians that are, say, you know, products of tensor products of poly X's or poly Z's or whatever, and then poly Z's, and then you know, you get to just sort of make one measurement of all the qubits at the end. You know, everything has to commute with each. All the Hamiltonians have to commute. So this, you know, we certainly don't know is universal. Okay, it's an example of a model where we don't know how to do Shor's algorithm. In fact, we don't know how to solve any decision problem in this model, which we don't know how to solve classically. Okay, but you know, Bremner, Joza, and Shepard pointed out that you can sample from probability distributions in this model that seem very hard to sample from by a classical computer. And in fact, if you could sample from these distributions in classical polynomial time, then the polynomial hierarchy would collapse to the third level. Okay, and Dan very elegantly summarized the argument for that. So somehow, you know, this model can, you know, seems to be able to do things that classical computing can't do. But in order to get those things, you somehow have to broaden your notion of what is a computational problem, okay, or what types of problems you're willing to consider, from decision problems to sampling problems. Okay, so which, you know, is something that, you know, we talk about in theoretical computer science, but I think that, you know, sampling problems assume a new importance because of this type of result. Okay, so okay, so independently of Bremner, Joza, and Shepard, Alex Arkhipov and I have been investigating a limited form of quantum computing for the last 2 years that turns out to lead to a quite similar story. Okay, where we don't know how to solve any hard decision problems, and yet we can get very good evidence that you can solve hard sampling problems in this model. Okay, and this model has additional interest in that it might be easier to actually physically implement than a full-scale universal quantum computer. Okay, so this is the model of we call linear optics with non-adaptive measurements. Okay, so the basic picture here. Is that you would imagine that you can reliably generate a bunch of single photon Fock states, and then you would pass them through a network of passive optical elements, beam splitters. Okay, and then you would at the other end, you know, have some an array of photo detectors that measure how many photons land in each mode. Okay, and that's it. That's all you can do in this model. If you've ever like been to a science museum where they show Galton's board, which is this board where you drop a bunch of balls into like a network of pegs, and then you look at, you know, where the balls land on the bottom, and it shows a binomial distribution. Okay, this is really just Galton's board, but with identical bosons instead of balls. Okay, and you know, because there's no explicit interaction between pairs of photons here. Okay, so for that reason, we're bypassing one of the biggest technological difficulties in actually building a quantum computer, which is how do you get the particles to talk to each other, right? You know, you don't need any Kerr media or whatever to, you know, the photons can all just fly past each other as photons like to do, and. At the end, you just need to measure where they all end up. Okay, now there's a famous, a celebrated result due to Knill, Laflamme, and Milburn from 2001, which says that if you have this model and you also include adaptive measurements, meaning that somewhere in the middle you can measure, you know, if there's a photon somewhere, and then depending on whether there is or not, you then do something else. Right, you condition, you know, you do something conditioned on the outcome of that measurement. Then, using linear optics, you can already build a universal quantum computer. Okay, but here we're also not assuming this capability of adaptive measurements. Okay, which is also, you know, rather difficult to arrange with photons. Okay, here all the measurements just happen in one shot at the very end. Okay, so these really are, you know, it seems, you know, weaker resources than are needed to implement all of BQP. Okay, and you know, maybe not surprisingly, you know, we have no idea if you can do Shor's algorithm, for example, with this type of device. We suspect that you can't. But you know, what's exciting is that you can sample from some probability distribution, which, if you could also sample from it efficiently with a classical computer, then you would collapse the polynomial hierarchy. Okay? So what is that distribution? Well, essentially, it's just the distribution over outcomes of this experiment predicted by quantum mechanics. Okay? There's, you know, a lot of thinking went into that. Okay? So, you know, all of the non-triviality is to argue that that distribution is hard to sample from with a classical computer. Okay, and actually, most of the technical work that we do is to say, well, what if you can only approximately sample from the distribution? Okay, would that still have, you know, major or unlikely complexity consequences? Okay, because, you know, realistically, there's always going to be noise in the experiment. Okay, so there, you know, the result is not, you know, as satisfying as we would like. We can't show that a noisy or approximate simulation would collapse the polynomial hierarchy, but we think it would. Okay, and you know, we can give a classical conjecture that looks very plausible, that we hope someone will prove, that if true would imply that even a noisy such implementation of this experiment would be doing something which is hard for any classical computer. Okay, so... let's see. So that was, you know, this is just one thing that's, you know, been exciting me recently. But you know, there's I think that this, you know, whole research direction of looking at the power of different intermediate models and, you know, what do they tell us about quantum computation, you know, is you know, has a lot more sort of fruit to be picked. Okay, so recently Steve Jordan came up with a model called permutational computing, permutational quantum computing, which again doesn't seem to give you the full power of BQP, but it is able to do something that we don't know how to do classically, which is to evaluate these 6J or 10J symbols that arise in quantum gravity. Okay, so I'm not going to say more about that because I don't understand it. But Okay, so one great open problem is it's possible that sort of just looking at a very, very noisy standard quantum computer, you know, gives you something which is intermediate between P and BQP. Okay, we don't know. What we know is that, you know, if you have a quantum computer with let's say, depolarizing noise, you know, which acts independently on each qubit at each time step, then if the rate of noise is below a certain threshold, then you can do quantum error correction. Okay, you can do fault tolerance, and you can actually do a universal quantum computation. Okay, this is one of the great achievements of the field, of course. Now, we also know that if the rate of noise is above a certain threshold, okay, then you can only do classical computation. Okay, the problem is, at least you can't do any more than log depth quantum computation. Okay, which that's not very convincing because, as I said before, log depth quantum computation already gives you Shor's algorithm. But probably you can only do classical computation in such models, right? The problem is that these two thresholds are very far from each other. The threshold is known to suffice for universality, you know, depending on what assumptions you make and how rigorous you want the estimate to be. It could be 10 to the minus 6, maybe up to 10 to the minus 3, something like that. Whereas the threshold that beyond which, you know, classical simulations become possible are a half or greater. Okay, so it's possible that there are intermediate regimes where you can do some of quantum computation, but not all of that, but not all of it. And I think it would be wonderful to clarify that. Okay, so let me end this part of the talk by just mentioning one of my favorite open problems. Okay, so the problem is this. We know many, many sets of quantum gates which are universal, okay, which if you can implement them, you know, reliably, then you can build a universal quantum computer. So, for example, the Toffoli gate plus the Hadamard gate, or the controlled knot gate plus a pi over 8 rotation gate, okay, and so forth. Okay, we also know some sets of gates that are not universal and that, in fact, can be simulated efficiently with a classical computer. Okay, the most famous example of this is the controlled knot plus the Hadamard plus the I phase gate, okay, which can be simulated classically by the famous Gottesman-Knill theorem. Okay, now the question that here is there any intermediate set of quantum gates? Okay, so is there a set of quantum gates which does not give you universal quantum computation, but which also cannot be efficiently simulated with a classical computer? Okay, so we don't know. I would, you know, if I was at gunpoint, I would guess that the answer is no, right? I would guess that there's some strict dichotomy that, you know, once you have some certain properties, you're universal, and otherwise you must be in one of these classically simulable sets like the Gottesman-Knill set. Okay, but I really don't know. And, you know, there's a whole territory here, you know, waiting to be explored. Okay. All right. So I wanted to mention one thing that has to do with the quantum black box model. Okay, so I've been talking about computational complexity, but much of what we actually know about quantum algorithms and their limitations is phrased within this black box model, where you only count the number of queries that a quantum algorithm makes to some oracle, and you ignore all of the other computational steps. Okay, and we focus on this model for the very good reason that we can actually prove things about it. Okay, so and also that lots of the quantum algorithms that we know, like Grover's algorithm, Shor's period finding algorithm, and so on, can actually be phrased very naturally within this model. Okay, so this is a concept that really needs a better name, but okay, so the usual way that the quantum black box model works is that you have some Boolean, you have some function f that you can query, and now you can have a superposition of over all the possible inputs to F, and then you can query F in superposition, and the answers get written coherently to some answer register. Okay, and lots and lots of quantum algorithms, you know, sort of have some piece that looks like this in them. Okay, consider a slight variation on this model where, you know, you can do the same thing, except now whenever you make a query, the register that contains f of x gets measured immediately. Okay, so in other words, you imagine that the register containing f of x is not coherent. Okay, the x's can be coherent, but, you know, these are... maybe to compute f, you know, you need some need a type of qubits that have really poor coherence properties. Okay, and so this sort of gets measured or traced out right away. Okay, now the interesting thing is that gives you a well-defined model of query complexity, which is intermediate between classical query complexity and quantum query complexity. Okay, so in this model, it is possible to implement Shor's algorithm, okay, because after all, in Shor's algorithm, you just measure the f of x right away anyhow, okay, when you compute the x to the r mod n, right, you just throw that away and you just look at what's left over in the first register. You know, that's how it works. Okay, so Shor's algorithm does work in this model, but Grover's algorithm does not work. Okay, for Grover's, to do Grover's algorithm, you would need to actually uncompute the contents of the f of x register, which you can't do if it's measured right away. Okay, so I think that there's probably a lot more to say about this model. Okay, so for example, you know, is there a Boolean function f that can be evaluated in this model asymptotically faster than it can be evaluated by a classical computer? Okay, I don't know of any example of such a function. Okay, but maybe there is one. Maybe I just, you know, haven't been able to imagine one. Okay. Okay. I did have an alternate name for this actually that I forgot about, which is this is another very creative name. This is the model of Shor-like algorithms. Okay. Okay. Fine. Okay, so we now move on to second part of the talk, which is superclasses of BQP. Okay, how can you change BQP to make it more powerful? All right. So there are a lot of classic ways to make BQP not only, to make quantum computing not only more powerful, but way more powerful. Okay, so the first of these is just insert some nonlinear term, could be a really, really small one, into the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so let quantum mechanics be nonlinear. You know, let the transformations between states, you know, not be linear. Okay, and there's a classic paper due to Abrams and Lloyd from 98. That points out that if you do this, then you know, you can very, very easily solve NP-complete problems in polynomial time, which, of course, is something that we don't know how to do with your garden variety quantum computer. Okay, and the reason is very simple, that it's quite easy in standard quantum mechanics to create a state that of one qubit, say, that will be zero if your satisfiability problem, let's say, has no solutions. And if your satisfiability problem has one solution, then it'll be exponentially close to that. Okay, you know, really, really, you know, like 0 plus 2 to the minus n times 1. Okay, you know, and now, of course, in standard quantum mechanics, the problem is, well, you can't distinguish these states very well. You would have to repeat the experiment exponentially many times in order to distinguish these two almost identical states by a measurement. Okay, but if quantum mechanics were nonlinear, then you wouldn't have to preserve the angle between quantum states. And so you could just sort of apply some transformation that just sort of pries these two states apart until they're nearly orthogonal. Okay, and in fact, even more than that, you could solve sharp P problems, which are counting problems. Okay, so you could, you know, really do a vast amount. Now you could also send superluminal signals, so you could have lots of fun. Okay. Okay, a related example is if you can make post-selected measurements. Okay, and Dan already touched on this in his talk. So I had a result from 2004, which says that this also, you know, well, certainly it lets you solve NP-complete problems, but even more than that, it lets you solve all of the problems in this larger complexity class called PP, which basically encapsulates the classical counting problems. Okay, so now this turns out to capture a large number of sort of fantasy versions of quantum mechanics. For example, if you allowed arbitrary linear and not necessarily unitary transformations, okay, and then you said that all right, at the end, if your state is not normalized, then it gets normalized by hand somehow. Okay, then that would take you to this post BQP class. Okay, likewise, if you change the Born rule from psi squared to psi cubed, or psi to some other power, okay, and again, you know, did the normalization by hand, okay, that would take you to this post-BQP class. Okay, so there's a lot of changes to quantum mechanics that have actually been proved to sort of snap you, exactly to this class post-BQP, which is much, much more powerful than ordinary quantum computation. Okay, the third example is quantum computing with closed time-like curves. And there's been, you know, a bunch of papers recently, you know, talking about the what's the right way to model this. David Deutsch had a famous proposal for how do you model closed time-like curves back in 1990. He said that there are sort of regions of space-time where you have to insist on a condition which is called causal consistency, okay, which basically means that you have some quantum operation acting, you know, around the closed time-like curve, maybe correlated with other parts of the universe that are not in the CTC. And now you need to find as the initial and final state of the closed time-like curve, you need to find some density matrix rho such that rho is a fixed point of that evolution operator. Okay, such that it's left invariant. So in other words, in order to sort of keep everything consistent, the universe is forced to find some mixed state rho, which is a fixed point of the evolution. Okay, and it's not hard to prove that at least one such fixed point always exists. Okay, there may be more than one of them, in which case I guess nature gets to pick one. But So for example, the resolution of the grandfather paradox is simply that you're born with half probability. If you're born, you go back in time to kill your grandfather, therefore you're born with half probability, and so on. Everything is consistent, right? There's no paradox, okay? But it turns out that in forcing nature to find these sort of fixed point density matrices, you can actually be forcing it to solve a very hard computational problem, okay? It's an easy exercise, for example, to force it to solve an NP complete problem. You can basically just say, look, assume that the initial state of the closed time-like curve represents one possible solution to the NP complete problem. Now check if the solution is correct. If it is correct, then just send it back in time as it is. If it's not correct, then increment it by one, wrapping around when you get to the end, and send that back in time. Okay, and then the only way for nature to be at a fixed point is for it to sort of give you a correct solution to start with. Okay, but in fact, you can even do more than that. John Watrous and I had a paper a few years ago where we showed that what you can do with a quantum computer with closed time-like curves in Deutsch's causal consistency model is exactly the class P space, okay, which is even more than quantum computing with post-selection, interestingly. And this is whether it's classical or quantum, actually. Since then, Bennett and Leung and others have proposed a different model of quantum computing with closed time-like curves, which gives you less, depending on how you choose to look at it. It can give you quantum computing with quantum advice, for example, which is a class called BQP/QPoly. And then Seth Lloyd and others have proposed yet another model of quantum computing with time travel that gives you post-BQP. Okay, so, all right, but I think that it's fair to say that sort of all of these FOIL theories are somehow way overshooting the target. You know, they're giving you more than standard quantum computing, but they're somehow giving you too much more. Okay, almost all of these, right, are giving you, at the very least, NP complete problems, even more than that, PP problems, P space problems. Okay, and so, for me, it's a very interesting question, how can you, generalize BQP? Okay, so are there FOIL theories that give you more than quantum computing, but sort of only a little bit more? Okay, one way to get a little bit more, I already mentioned, it's this model of quantum computing with quantum advice. If you don't want to incorporate advice, then actually I only know of one way so far to get sort of a little bit more than BQP. Okay, so I'd like to sort of tell you about that as my last FOIL theory, my last example. Okay, so there's a model that I thought about quite a while ago, which is you could call quantum computing with non-collapsing measurements. Okay, so all this is just like standard quantum mechanics, except now you get multiple chances to measure the same state. Okay, in the same basis, without affecting it. Okay, so. Okay, so you can define that mathematically, and you can ask, what could we do in such a model? Okay, so the first thing is I claim that in this model, we can pretty easily solve the graph isomorphism problem in polynomial time. Okay, so graph isomorphism, problem where, you know, you're given two graphs by their adjacency matrices, and you want to know whether they're isomorphic. Okay, and this is something that we don't yet know how to solve with a standard quantum computer. You know, it may very well be possible. In fact, it might even be possible with a classical computer. You know, we just don't know enough graph theory yet. Okay, but with this a non-collapsing measurement quantum computer, it would be quite easily solved. How? Well, all you would have to do is prepare a state like the following. So a uniform superposition over all permutations on 2n vertices of that permutation together with that permutation applied to the graph on 2n vertices, which is given by the union of G and H. Okay? Now, imagine that you just measure the second register and you look at what's left in the first register. Okay, then it's a well-known observation that, you know, this the state of the first register will look very different if G and H are isomorphic than if they're not. Okay, if they're not isomorphic, then you'll get a superposition over permutations, sort of all of which, you know, map G to one graph and H to the other graph. Right, whereas if G and H are isomorphic, then you'll get a superposition over permutations that sort of go both ways, that can cross. Okay, and so, you know, it's been, you know, sort of known for a while by, you know, by people studying the hidden subgroup problem that, you know, damn, if only we could measure the state twice, you know, we'd be done. We'd see whether the graphs are isomorphic. Okay, so here's a model where you can do it. Okay. Now, all right. That may not sound too exciting. Let me tell you something that may be a little bit less obvious. And that is that in this model, you can solve the Grover search problem of searching a list of n elements for a single marked element in cube root of n steps instead of square root of n. Okay, needed by Grover. Okay, how do you do it? All right. Well, once I tell you, it's pretty easy. All you do is you first run cube root of n iterations of Grover's algorithm. Okay, that boosts the probability of the marked item to cube root of n squared divided by n, which is 1 over cube root of n, and then you measure cube root of n times. Okay, and then, you know, there's a very good chance that then you're going to find the marked item because it had a 1 in cube root of n probability. Okay, so, but now here's the really interesting thing to me. Okay, you can prove that even in this FOIL theory with non-collapsing measurements, this cube root of n Grover search is optimal. Okay, so in order to solve the Grover search problem, you actually need cube root of n steps. Okay, so this is a model that improves the time needed for search from square root of n to cube root of n, but no further than that. Okay, so probably this is still not a model where you can solve NP complete problems in polynomial time, right? At least there's some oracle relative to which you can't. Okay, so this is a model that generalizes BQP by a little bit, you know, apparently, so enough to capture graph isomorphism, you know, and enough to capture several other problems that are sort of expressible in this sort of way, like breaking cryptographic hash functions, anything that has what's called a statistical zero-knowledge proof protocol. Okay, so you snag some more of these NP intermediate problems, but probably still not the NP complete problems. Okay, you only improve Grover from square root of n to cube root of n, not to constant or to log of n. Okay, now why did I care about this? Because I was interested in the following question. Suppose you believe a hidden variable theory, like Bohmian mechanics, right? Then suppose that sort of counterfactually, you could see the entire trajectory which was followed by the hidden variable throughout the entire course of a quantum computation. In standard quantum mechanics, of course, we only get to measure it at one time. You know, at any one time, it follows the Born rule. Okay, but suppose that you could see where it's been everywhere in the past and could see all the multi-time correlations. Then what kind of computations would that enable you to do, right? So, you know, if at the moment of your death, your whole life history flashes before you in an instant, what can you compute in polynomial time from your life history? Okay, and and now it's not hard to see that in this model, you could actually simulate the non-collapsing measurements model, okay, because, you know, all you have to do is set up the appropriate state and then just sort of jiggle things around so that the hidden variable is first at one basis element and then moves over to another one so that then when you inspect the whole history, you see both places where it's been. Okay, so certainly you could solve graph isomorphism in this model, where you get to see the whole history, but still, probably not the NP-complete problems. Okay, so I would love to have more examples of models that generalize BQP, but only by a little bit. You know, right now this is sort of the only such example that I know. Okay, now the third thing we could look for would be classes, foil theories that give you models of computation that are incomparable with BQP. Okay, but this is a short section of the talk because I don't know of any such example. Okay, maybe quantum mechanics over finite fields would give you a good example. I saw there was a recent paper about it. I don't know. So, you know, in conclusion, I think none of these foils for BQP is really as satisfying, you know, as I would like. I mean, quantum mechanics itself is really a hard act to follow, right? But at least, you know, I think they give rise to lots and lots of meaty research questions and maybe some conceptual or philosophical questions as well, but that's for you to tell me. So thank you.
Questions? I'm very curious about these non-adaptive, passive computation made with beam splitters. It seems to me that this is very easy to simulate by a classical computer in polynomial time because you have the conservation of the number of photons. Mm-hmm. So the representation of SUN breaks down into irreducible representation. You diagonalize each one in cubic time, and you have just another... Mm-hmm.
So when we gave this, you know, when we presented this work to physicists, a lot of them said that you know, oh, this seems easy to simulate classically. And eventually we traced down the root of the misunderstanding, which is that they imagined that the input states were coherent states, okay, which are the output of a standard laser.
The states are mixed.
What?
The input states are mixed.
No, the input states are single photon Fock states, and that's very important.
With given number of photons?
With given fixed number of photons.
Then it's even easier because it's just one irreducible component of the representation. So I diagonalize a matrix which has dimension, polynomial in N.
We can talk about it offline, but there are certain other related problems that are easy. One of them is if you want to estimate, if you're only interested in the probability of seeing a particular photon number in some specific mode, or in fact in any constant number of modes. That can be done in polynomial time. But to sample the entire distribution, I can actually prove to you that if you can do that classically, then you'll collapse the polynomial hierarchy, which, you know, I'll be very interested if you can do that.
It's So there's an interesting connection between foil theories and axiomatizations of, mm-hmm. of quantum theory,
yes.
or axiomatic systems. So you know, mm-hmm. one connection is that by having a sort of landscape of possible theories, we might be able to find some principles that pick out quantum theory and mm-hmm. you mentioned that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But another connection is that it's if you're devising a foil theory, it's useful to start with a set of axioms, because if you know that your axioms are logically independent, then you can be sure that the thing you're defining is not logically inconsistent.
Yeah.
And so when you're describing some of these computational models, I wondered whether you're running the risk of actually defining something that's not consistent. Like
okay.
you talked about psi cubed Born rules would be a good
yeah,
example
yeah.
of something with very weak assumptions
right.
to get you to the psi squared
I
rule.
I see. So look, so I'm pretty sure that all the things I told you about are logically consistent. You know, I can't say much more for them than that. But
okay.
but you know, in particular, I mean, you know, for each of these things, I can tell you what is the model of computation that I have in mind, right? So I can give you a mathematically well-defined complexity class. So for example, with the psi cube thing, you know, all I would say is do an ordinary quantum computation. Okay, then at the end, you know, you make a measurement, and what is the probability, you know, of a particular outcome? Well, I define that to be the you know amplitude cubed divided by the sum of the amplitudes cubed. Okay, and you know so you know now it's quite true that if you try to extend this model of computation into a larger physical theory or you know a larger picture of physical reality, right, then you know you'll very, very quickly run into all kinds of inconsistencies, right? But then you're introducing kind of implicitly side assumptions, which are not part of the computational model itself.
So would it be fair to say that if your motivation would be to come up with foil physical theories,
yes.
you might want to pare down this list of computational models to those that play well with reasonable assumptions?
Sure, absolutely. Then the problem is that we just have too few foil theories. It's like you have to break something if you want a foil theory, right?
I have a couple of short questions. Mm-hmm. One is that I found very intriguing the improvement from one n squared to n to the cube.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you have a further intuition about this mm-hmm. besides the protocol itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple of other quick questions. So as far as I understand it, this quantum computation with non-collapsing measurements means that we allow ourselves as many copies we want of the input mm-hmm. state. Just mm-hmm. if this,
yes.
am I correct?
Oh well, okay. Well. So I'm not assuming cloning per se, but I'm just assuming that you get one fixed state and then measure it multiple mm-hmm. times.
Yeah. Yes, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And about the permutation
yes.
computer. So
yes.
Just to have a rough idea, does it mean that we can use unitaries that permute over a basis and any arbitrary input state?
No. So basically, what he does is he considers these very specific input states that have this motivation from quantum gravity, actually, from spin networks and things like that. And then he says, you know, in this model, the only operations I'm going to allow you to do is to permute n particles around. Right, so there's only n factorial operations in this entire model, but because of the weird basis that you're starting in, that already gives you some interesting computational power. Okay, now with regard to the cube root of n, I mean, in this model, it simply comes from trading off two things. Okay, so so basically, it comes from solving this, right? Okay. So Grover's algorithm, you know, has this n t squared over n behavior in terms of the probability that you're going to see the marked item if you measure after t steps, right? And so then, you know, that says that you've got to make n over t squared measurements if you want to see the marked item, right? But then, you know, you also need to do t steps of Grover, right? So solve for t to make these two things equal. And you just get cube root of n. Okay, that's where it comes from here. And actually, cube root of n, I should say, shows up in a lot of different places in quantum computing theory, like for the collision problem, the local search problem. It often shows up as a complexity, and for exactly this reason, that you're sort of trading off two things, and cube root of n is where the optimum happens. By the way, it's a great challenge, which I'd like to put out to all of you. Come up with some natural foil theory that lets you do Grover search in fourth root event time. But not better than that.
Okay, if there are no more questions, we thank school again.
Thank you.